Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Science of Sports Podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch.
So, welcome to another episode of The Science of Sport. My name is Mike Finch, and as usual, I'm here with Professor Ross Tucker. And for those of you that listen to us on a regular basis, you will know that we are 3 episodes into season 5. So, 5 years of us doing this amazing podcast. And thank you for all your support out there, to our Patreon supporters and to our Twitter involvement people who are getting involved in some of the discussions that we have on this podcast. Always fascinating to hear from you. So today we've got a very interesting interview with a gentleman who has written a book all about drugs, particularly in the South African scenario. But even though we know that most of our listeners are based overseas, we felt that there was a lot of international relevance around what this book is all about. And some of the stories that come out of it are quite extraordinary. And some of the examples we feel are probably global in many different ways. But before we get on to that, Professor Ross Tucker has got some caught my eyes, which he wants to get into.
Yeah, just one this week. It's been a really busy work week. And so there's a whole bunch of these sitting in Patreon. And I've replied to some of you, but I'm making my way slowly through a backlog of emails that developed over the festive season. So I apologize for the delays, but I'll get there eventually. But there's some really interesting ones. Chris Froome's VO2 max test, which I want to look into in a bit more detail before I comment, lest I get something wrong. There have been a few others about studies that have caught your eye, like we featured last week. But one thing that caught my eye, and that's the one I want to talk about today, is that the UFC, who you'll know is the main
Ultimate
body,
Fighting Championship,
right, that delivers mixed martial arts in the United States, is embarking on a new league called Power Slap. Now, I've watched this so that you don't have to, but I'm going to post.
But you should watch it.
Yeah, I'm going to post an article that I came across last night on Sports Illustrated, written by John Wertheim. He's a really good writer. The article's called "I Embraced MMA, but Slap Fighting, What Are We Doing Here?" And so it's an appraisal of where MMA and UFC came from over the round from 2001 and how it grew, how initially there was this public resistance, like people fighting in a cage and trying to literally knock one another out, potentially kill each other. Now, that hasn't happened, although some of the injuries in the sport are pretty severe. But he talks about how over time that became accepted and it's now largely mainstream, some fights being shown on national television channels.
Yeah.
But what they're now doing is they're embarking on this thing called Power Slap, which comes from slap fighting. And the name pretty much tells you what it is. Imagine, you know, when we finish our rides on a Friday, sometime we end up at the high table at the bar. And so let's say it's a clock face. You're at 12, I'm at 6. We stand facing off against one another, and I'm going to slap you on the face as hard as I can. And it's one for one, and there are 3 in total. So each person gets to slap the other one 3 times as hard as possible. I'll post a YouTube video that I found last night of some.
I can't deny that it's great to watch. Well, I hate that I like it.
It's cringe. I cringe when I watch it. It's cringeworthy. And like I flinch every time they hit one another because. So what's happening here is you're supposed to use the palm of your hand open to hit the guy on the face, and you win through points for the quality of your slaps or by knockout. Now, a knockout by definition is a concussion. So that the purpose of this quote-unquote sport is to cause concussion to win it. If you don't win it, I suppose you can win it via points, but you're winning points by getting closer and closer to concussion anyway. So the whole premise here is how can I deliver a concussion to a guy who is defenseless? He's not allowed to do anything in defense. That's different from MMA and UFC boxing. At least there, you can rely on your own skill and evasive maneuvering and so forth to defend yourself. Here, you basically have to keep your jaw up and your head steady. No flinching allowed, no drawing back, and that's it. So this is now where they're going into. And again, I've watched it so you don't have to. Like I saw a couple of cases where these, we call them fighters, are clearly concussed. They get slapped and there are two guys behind him who catch him. And then he gets up. He's got 30 seconds. He gets up and he has a go at his opponent. He's concussed, but the fight continues.
Yeah.
So that's also ridiculous. And so I don't know. I mean, people can do what they want. There's free will and so forth. But it just feels to me in the current climate of long-term health by brain injury, long-term health outcomes caused by brain injury, the concussion stuff we've spoken about on this podcast, I couldn't believe that people are embarking on this as a commercial enterprise. It's unbelievable.
I mean, you just alluded to the fact that there are so many sports that are trying to avoid concussions because of legal ramifications that might come down the line. I mean, does it feel that a sport like this, there's clearly going to be some ramifications, I bet, for some of those players or participants?
Yeah.
But could they sue on the basis of the sport didn't do enough? Well, no, because they've clearly taken the risk and they know what the risk is.
Somehow they'll get lawyers to indemnify the organization against that. No, there are quotes in this article you can read where people have said, well, we don't know fully the risk of these injuries, but I think we know enough now. 10 years ago, yes. 20 years ago, for sure. But now I think there's enough known to say that this is probably going to cause problems if you expose yourself too often to them. So they'll have to sign something, and then the sport will say, you knew the risks when you took part. People say that about rugby now. They say that about rugby 20 years ago. I don't know that we did know about the risks of brain injuries 20 years ago. If we had, we'd have done more then. We're doing a lot. Well, some people reject that. I think we're doing a lot now because we know the risks. How can this then start in the current environment of knowing these risks? And as you might expect, boxing is the comparison here. Mm. And the organizers say, like, in a boxing match, you'll get hit in the head with 300 to 400 punches in a fight. Okay, that's not true. There's not that many thrown. These guys are going to get hit with 3 slaps. So they're trying to defend it on the basis it's only 3 and they're only slaps. But there, you know, it's a slap. And when you watch them, you'll see a lot of the time they use the base of the hand. Mm. And that's not a slap anymore. That's actually using your hand like a hammer or an axe. It's a chop more than it is a slap. And you'll hear the impact on some of them. It's not slapping sounds coming out of this. It's hitting sounds. And also, when you cause rotation, that's a high risk for a brain injury because then you know, people often think direct impact to the head, but a rotational force is just as important. Some of the stuff we're doing with mouthguards at the moment is showing that your head injuries in rugby are not only attributable to linear acceleration, you know, things that cause your head to go forward or backwards or sideways. Rotational is as likely because you get shear forces and torsion inside the skull. So that, and then the final point is there's no ability to defend yourself. So it's just like, you know, I spend most of my work week thinking about how to prevent head impacts in rugby. And meanwhile, some people are embarking on a competition that is designed to only cause head impacts that cause concussions.
Not to put a spoke in the wheel, but to some extent, it does open the question as to when is a sport too dangerous? Because there are obviously lots of sports where there is a risk. And whether that risk is calculated or not, boxing, of course, being one of them, there is, of course, a risk. Mm. And you can't change the nature of the sport to make it completely risk-free because otherwise you change the sport.
No.
You know, I always think about the Gloucester cheese roll when they have to race down the mountain to yes. chase the cheese. There is a risk that you're going to break a limb going down there, but you voluntarily choose to do that or not.
Right.
And I guess that's the whole debate around what happens with any sport, that whether there is contact involved, to what extent is there a risk?
And you could and this goes a little off piste, is you could even argue that for activities of daily living, some of which are more extreme, climbing Everest is quite dangerous. Climbing K2, even more dangerous. Mm. For some reason, Instagram is showing me all these videos of K2 in the last month, and it's unbelievable. Some of the, like, it looks as dangerous as I know it is. Mm. Yet no one's made that illegal because people have the will to do that, or the right, the free will to choose. Similarly, driving your car can be deemed to be dangerous. Not as dangerous as it might be, given the fact that we make people qualify. We make the cars roadworthy. We ensure that they've got airbags. We ask people to wear seatbelts and to obey speed limits and so forth. So I guess the point I'm making is that even in sport, even when a sport is dangerous, as long as the authorities are doing everything that is reasonable to minimize that danger, the sport can continue.
Yeah.
So in boxing, there are concussion checks. There is a referee who is meant to stop the fight when there is an indication of a severe injury to a fighter so that he's not defenseless against further impacts. In cycling, for instance, remember there's all that controversy around what the finish straight looks like. Mm-hmm. You can't have a 90-degree bend 200 meters out when cyclists are trying to go 65, 70 k an hour. Mm-hmm. It's very dangerous. The cars have to be cleared. The barriers have to meet certain...
Yes, like you have to mitigate the risk.
A sprint finish is an incredibly dangerous activity, but as long as that risk is mitigated, it can continue with everyone's agreement. And I think that's the point. Mm. So again, here, they'll argue that they're minimizing that risk. They'll have checks on the fighters. They'll make sure that they're okay and so forth. But I don't know. At this point, it does feel like it's getting closer to that line to me.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, as I say, it's something that you might take an interest in watching, but as Ross says, if you don't, we have watched it, and it's something that is quite surprising to watch. Anyway, let's move on to our subject of today, and that is the book that we mentioned right at the start of the podcast. It's called Guns and Needles, A Journey into the Heart of South African Sports, Steroid and Drug Culture. And even though it is a South African story, we feel there are very many global examples. And the author of that book is Clinton van der Berg. It came out in January 2022, so we're a little bit late in reviewing it, but I just started reading it. And what's interesting about Clinton is he comes from a very strong journalistic background. He's an award-winning sports writer. He was the sports editor and sports writer for the Sunday Times newspaper, which is probably one of the biggest and most respected sports publications amongst other publications in South Africa. He is currently the head of communications at SuperSport, which is a South African TV channel. But most importantly, he is a man who really knows how to cover the beat and discover the story. And as you'll see in this story, figuring out how to speak to people who are involved in the drug game here in South Africa, talking to the people who have been caught, the excuses they come up with is a fascinating example. And Ross, I think what came out of that discussion, and as you'll see in our discussion with him, is that it took a long time to get those stories. They're not necessarily surprising, but some of the detail that I didn't know is what Clinton brings to this discussion.
Yeah, it's very much insider, right? It's someone who has successfully managed to get across the barrier and embed himself to the extent of, and he'll tell you that he's used the drugs himself.
Yeah.
What he said, 20 years ago.
Yeah, a long time ago, yeah.
He had a friend, and that's how he discovered how accessible they are. And he'll relate that story to you in this interview. He'll give you some other accounts of exactly what he's learned, who's doing what, when, how. And so this is there's a shroud of mystery around doping. And I think whilst this interview doesn't blow it wide open and reveal everything, it's going to give you a lot of insight into what happens. So, yeah.
Here we go then, Clinton van der Berg. Right, so Clinton, welcome to the Science of Sports podcast. It's interesting when I spotted this book in a local bookstore here in South Africa, Guns and Needles is the title of it. I thought it was an older book than it actually was, but as you told us before the podcast, it came out just over a year ago. But the first question I've actually got for you is more of a journalistic one, more than anything to do with science. And as a journalist myself, I was fascinated to know how you got people to talk to you about these things, because in my experience of trying to get people who have been drug cheats and those sort of things to actually talk about their experience is quite difficult. Was there some methodology behind it?
Hi, Mike, and Prof, thanks very much. That's a very good question. And what I in fact relied on, having been a sports journalist previously in my earlier life, was, you know, those tactics, how you assure the person that you're interviewing that you're going to take a nuanced look at it. It's not an expose, anything like that. And what was very interesting for me is there's no great revelations in the book. All of this stuff is on the public record. And what I discovered, not with all, but with many of the athletes, is they were quite willing to talk. And what helped in some instances was the passage of time. So it allowed them a little bit of perspective. Obviously, the hullabaloo had died down. Those kind of things. And I also think that I managed to develop an element of trust, which is important, that you are going to tell their story in a fair way. Now, of course, I contacted some athletes who refused to talk whatsoever. I think the prominent rugby player, Piwe Janchi, was one. There was Gerard Krobler, who's now playing for the Sharks, played very good rugby. He's another. Although he had a tell-all in the Daily Mail in the UK, he felt that he wanted to put it behind him. He had copped a lot of flack over the years, and he just shut down. And, you know, I could appreciate that from a lot of athletes who didn't want to talk, but I was quite encouraged by those who did. And like you say, it's not easy, but, you know, you work those contacts and you try as much as you can to assure them that you will be true to their story.
What was the most animosity you experienced? Was there anyone who was openly hostile as opposed to avoidant?
That's a good question. In fact, not. I was very surprised. And even subsequent to the publishing of the book, people have said there's been fallouts, etc. Not too much at all, which is great, because I didn't make any inflated claims or whatever in the book. You know, rugby's history is well documented, and the issues within schoolboy rugby, for instance, athletics, cycling, all those things are out there. And Ross, I'll be honest, there was very little blowback on what appeared.
What's interesting is you get into in some stages of the book where you talk about the sort of criminal underbelly of some of the steroid producers and the people that supply the steroids in South Africa. Was there any? Did you ever feel unsafe uncovering and writing about that sort of stuff? Because obviously there's a fair amount of money involved, and people who might make money out of it might feel that they're at risk of being exposed.
Yeah, that's a good question, because those cases you talk of, I mean, certainly there are two murders recorded in the book linked to steroids, but obviously you can't speak to those individuals. But I spoke to people around them, and they were a little bit cagey, a little bit coy. There was a big case in Potchefstroom where a guy was bust for an enormous amount of steroids. And then I spoke to an old boxing pal of mine who's now in his early 50s, and he's been taking juice for 30 years, but he deals on the side as well. And he warned me about the implications. But I, at no point, did I feel threatened or anything. I spoke to one dealer who is referred to by his first name in the book, and I kind of relate our exchange, and you kind of play this dance, you know, because what I was trying to find out from was, you know, who does he supply, how does he supply, why does he supply, and how does it all work? And like I say, it was this very kind of edgy, nervous dance, and he was very reluctant to come out and give me his full name, which was fine. I accepted it. And that's pretty much how I had to play it around those very severe cases.
I mean, obviously, we'd like to explore that supply chain stuff a bit more, but not entirely tongue-in-cheek. I suspect some of them would actually see the book as promotional. given the way that anti-doping and doping works, and how many supplements, quote unquote, and drugs are available through fitness clubs and gyms and so on, and there's no prosecution to the user. Yeah. Many of these guys might say, actually, the book is quite good publicity for us. So maybe there's that. Not entirely tongue-in-cheek. Question from me is, why do you care about doping? Like, you're a journalist, and I dare say many of your colleagues, not only in South Africa but around the world, are quite happy to turn a blind eye to doping because it tarnishes the product. So why would you even care enough to write this book?
That's a great question. So my early instincts were around being a reporter back in the day. And every couple of months, I'd be tripping over these stories, having to pursue some, etc. And what I am at heart, I'm a storyteller, and I love to hear stories. And almost without fail, every single one of these cases has a backstory that's remarkable. It's never dull. It's never boring. It's never uninteresting. I care because I've been exposed to elite level sport, primarily as a reporter, a bit like Mike, having done Olympic Games and World Cups and things like that. And clean sport matters to me in that context. I was at the 2000 Olympic Games where Marion Jones was one of the superstars, and we all know what happened there. I mean, it ended very messily. Subsequently, my wife was married to an Olympic high jump champion. So he was kind of part of the family. He won an Olympic gold in 2012 and, in fact, lost his medal just because he was caught up in that whole Russian doping scandal as well. So a lot of this is quite close to home. And then working quite closely with boxing and being ringside for these things, I've got to know a lot of the fighters, some of whom have been caught for doping as well. And ultimately, you know, when you read the headlines and things like that, it's all quite academic, etc. But it's generally quite an appalling sort of human interest story. You know, there's tears and there's sadness, there's disappointment, there's stupidity. It's all kind of blended in. So the kind of human side of it is what appeals to me as well. And there's so many dichotomies, and the guys who talk, the guys who don't talk, the people who are in absolute denial, who are in the majority. I was quite drawn in by that, and I tried to get my head around it. And I must tell you, I came in to this project thinking things were black and white. But as you'll know, and as I discover often listening to your podcast, there's often a lot of gray when it comes to things like stimulants, like steroids, like doping.
When you were going through this process, I'm always fascinated to know whether there are people at the elite. I mean, you'll probably get a sense of this from the people that you spoke to. Is there this sense amongst professional athletes that unless you are doping, you can't be competitive? Or is it on the other side, athletes believe that they feel very aggrieved when they feel like they have to take drugs to be, they do it just because they want to be competitive. Is it a sort of, I often think about cyclists who are up and coming young riders, and they get to 19, 20 and somebody comes along and says to them, well, unless you're doing something, you're not going to be competitive. Is it that sense of like, well, I have to do it, otherwise I'm not going to be competitive?
Wasn't there, sorry to interrupt before you answer, wasn't there a case of a top cyclist in Europe who got stopped on a ride once for a test and he knew he was glowing and he said, I'll retire on the spot. So why did you do it? He says, well, what was my choice? I got paint houses.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the...
That's the scenario.
I don't know if that was one of those made up tales, but I remember hearing or thinking, you know, that's a great analogy or an illustration of it. You know, the choice is I can take the drug or I can go paint a house.
Yeah. And I remember speaking to a triathlete a good decade ago who said that it was his full-time job and that it was the only thing he was good at. And he was literally willing to, I said to him, if you knew you were going to die at the age of 40, but win the Olympic gold, what would you choose? And he said, I'd take the drugs, because that was that sense. But so what was your general feeling around that issue?
Yeah, about a month or two after the book was published, I took a call from a female runner. She was a Comrades gold medalist. And she said to me, she should be out there running. And she says, you know exactly who's on the juice and who isn't. And she said, it's heartbreaking. And I have spoken to athletes who feel compelled to take it. But as I discovered, one of my really great sources was Dr. Khalid Khalant, who heads up the South African Institute for Drug-Free Sport. And I discovered it's not always about performance. Vanity comes into it as well. So you'd have athletes who aren't necessarily elite athletes or even just ordinary weekend warriors. You'd have taken it for vanity. And then you'd have guys who felt the pressure of having to fulfill a contract. They say, you've got to get back on the field. You've got to get back on the bike. There's no question. That certainly happened with Owen Honey, the cyclist. And he felt really he was under enormous pressure to get back. Then there's recovery as well. And then finally, performance, no doubt. And that view was communicated several times. Just to say, I'm not in the game. You know, if I'm not on something and I know full well that others are using it, you know, I feel it's a risk worth taking.
And is there, it's obviously a blanket statement to suggest that is across all sport. Are there more sports that you saw that are more inclined to be, well, we've just got to do this, and other sports that are less inclined to feel that way? I mean, I know it's probably a difficult question to answer.
Yes, certainly the chief ones where that was particularly apt was at rugby, particularly South Africa, where there's this obsession with size. So it's often to bulk up, and you know, the traditional old-time steroids like testosterone, et cetera, that helps you bulk up. So that certainly came through. And then similar narratives in athletics as well, obviously where the margins are tiny and you need to make those up. I'd say it was most prevalent in those two sports.
Mm-hmm. And especially, might I add, it's rugby from schoolboy age.
Yeah.
And so the problem you've got, there's a few issues, some of which are like conceptual things people must get their head around, is if you're a 16-year-old boy and you feel that pressure to dope, to perform, to retain your spot in the team, because we've got such an aggressive pipeline. It goes from school into professional rugby. You know, you're in a shop window, then you get bought. Then you stay in the next shop window till you get selected for the Springboks. So as people must wrap their heads around, why would you dope all the way through school and then stop as a pro? And secondly, like, you're creating behaviors, habits in young athletes that then is likely to perpetuate forward. So that's clearly a problem. I don't think, though, that it's unique to South Africa. I have a difficult time persuading me that other countries don't have a similar obsession.
I mean, obviously this book is very much a South African story, but did you get a sense that this is happening all over the world, particularly talking, let's talk specifically about the rugby issue, because you go into quite a lot of depth in that in your book. Schoolboy rugby, that the pressure to perform, the pressure to bulk up, do you think that's a global issue?
In rugby, certainly. I mean, the cases all the time. But then moving across other sports, so we see the Russian situation where athletes had been involved in state-sponsored doping. You can remember the Winter Olympics back in Sochi. And that hasn't abated. Almost every month, the lists come out and Russians are caught on them. There was, I think it was a hammer thrower last week who came out and confessed that he had taken the steroids. And then, of course, you know what's happening in Kenya as well. It's become ubiquitous in Kenyan athletics. So I've no doubt it happens. Now, the issue with South Africa, and I think it's credit to say, is that they have a lot of testing, a lot of aggressive testing, not enough testing, because, of course, there's huge cost implications to that as well. But they try to cover as much as they can. And they're very public. They have a very liberal, open-minded leader in Khalid Khalant, who's out there, he's talking. So I think SAIDS do quite a good job. So South Africa's reputation, I think, is linked to the rate of testing, which is significant.
Yeah. So that was one of the things we actually were talking about before the podcast, and suggesting that because South Africa is one of the countries which you mentioned is one of the, you know, one of the highest cases of doping in the world relative to our size, is the suggestion then that it is because testing is working, or is because this is a massive problem that we're just touching the iceberg? So you're suggesting that it's because we're doing a pretty good job in terms of exposing these people?
Yes, but I'd like to add another dimension to this, which I found fascinating, is talking to Khalid Khalant. And he speaks about South Africa's diminishing morality and lack of regard for ethics in the kind of in the whole social space, you know, where people drive through red lights and they chance their arm with things, and there's a very limited law enforcement, that kind of thing. So, and, you know, sport doesn't act as an island. You know, sport reflects broader society. So that whole thing about taking chances and flirting with what's right or what's illegal or what isn't. South Africans tend to think it's cool, you know, let's give it a go. Everyone does it, you know, let's try it. And for me, that put a completely new spin on things, because I do think that ethics aren't the be all and end all in our sport, certainly not in wider society.
Yeah.
I mean, part of it is that many countries have adopted the equivalent of Donald Trump's approach to COVID. Remember when he said, just stop testing and the pandemic will be over.
True.
That's the anti-doping equivalent in many places. But that point about sport not being an island is really important. And Clinton alluded to this. There's a guy called Glenn Hagerman who's done a lot of research in schoolboy rugby, particularly in Natal, which is, for the listeners overseas, is a province or state in South Africa. And he's found that like lifetime prevalence of steroid use in schoolboys is up towards 10%. That's confessed. So there's probably more who are saying, I'm not telling you, even if you guarantee anonymity. And then they say, well, why do you do it? Why do you take the drugs? And to that point, 63% in 2011 said to look good, which was twice as many as to improve performance.
Wow.
So schoolboys dope mainly for vanity reasons. Mm. Now, if you're a first team rugby player, you've got two pressures. Plus peer pressure, because all the mates who don't play rugby are taking it for other reasons. Mm. And so if it's a societal problem, why would it be exempt from being a sporting problem? See, that's the point. And now you say in England, is there the same pressure to look good for young men? Yes. Young women too, different drugs maybe, but it's there.
Yeah.
So of course it's going to spill over into doping, especially if the testing is inadequate. And one of the problems in minors is you can't test them without parental consent.
Mm.
Now, 1 in 10 athletes who dope have parental peer pressure and parents who are providing the drug. So do you think the parents will consent to the testing? No. And if they don't all consent, none consent. So they never get tested. So we never know the extent of the problem.
I mean, let's delve a little bit into that schoolboy issue, because it is a big part of the book. And I'm quite fascinated to find, I've had occasion of meeting somebody whose brother was going into university and wanted to play first team rugby and was told he literally had to put on 10 kilos between his matricula and the start of his university. And the only way to do that was to do the drugs. Is that, we talked about the fact that there's obviously a vanity element to it, but it also spills into a performance element into it. If you look at South African rugby as a rule, is it a sense that there's a requirement to be a certain size as you go through the ranks? In other words, is bulk such a key thing? You talked a little bit in the book about some of the youngsters that have come through that are lighter and more agile and playing a different style of rugby, but is it literally like, well, you've got to be this kind of weight and to be a top class rugby player? I mean, is that a said thing given your experience in the rugby space?
I relate the story of one young player who rocked up at training in a junior system where the coach said to him, listen, you need to go to the fridge, you know, which was a euphemism, you know, you need to sort yourself out, definitely. I still think that's incredibly important. So you do have the smaller size players, people like Ches and Colby, previously somebody like Warren Whiteley, you might think, Curtly Aronson, those kind of guys who show that it remains a game for all shapes and sizes. But there's still no question, starting at schoolboy level, there is this obsession with size. Guys have to go away. I interviewed a former coach, a guy called Sean Hagen, who had coached at Durbanville. And the claim was, not only was he okay with the boys using steroids, but he actually injected two of the boys. Anyway, Sean Hayford was fired. He's quit. He was a provincial coach as well. He went up to Griquas, coached a little bit there as well. But I think that's ample evidence of the unhealthy obsession with getting big, which remains. And there were cases like which say it's heard where players misinterpreted what the coach said. So he said, go away and get big. And they thought that meant they need to go and juice. But what he meant was, you know, go eat your meat and veg and get in the gym. You know, just work a hell of a hard. So it's even, you know, the messaging comes under scrutiny as well. And often the assumption is, listen, if I need to put on 10 kilos in 2 months, there's only one way to do it.
Look, I agree size is an obsession, but I genuinely don't think that's a South African issue. I know marketing has taught us that South Africans are big thuggery type rugby players. But like when you look at the actual numbers from the World Cup, we are not the biggest team. We don't have the highest mass among our forwards. We don't have the biggest under-20s any longer. So South Africans are the same size as all rugby players around the world. So if that problem exists here, that problem exists there.
And are rugby players, I mean, do we know whether the rugby players have increased in size in the last decade or two decades? They have.
I mean, I published a study actually on that. We looked at data from every World Cup going back to 91. And up to 2007, it increased progressively, with the biggest increase coming after 95, because that was when it got professional. Mm. And professionalism brings with it better nutrition, better training, yes, but also more incentives to dope and funding to dope and wherewithal to dope. So the two things are always linked. But then in about 2007, it plateaued. So they haven't gotten any bigger since then among the backs. And in the forwards, I think 2011 onwards, they've now stabilized.
I mean, is it fair to say that there is the suspicion about how that size has increased, or is it just conjecture to suggest that it's...
It's always fair to be suspicious, of course. It's necessary.
I mean, Clinton, what's interesting about you is that not only have you written this great book, but you've been very involved in rugby, as we talked about. One of the interesting sports you talk about is boxing. Now, boxing is unique in that you've got all these different federations that run these different global titles that you can do in IBF and WBA, et cetera, et cetera. That's one sport where there seems to be absolutely no control, and boxers themselves almost have to agree to do doping on both sides of the fight before they agree to do doping. Tell us a bit about the boxing scenario and where it sits globally and maybe more specifically in South Africa.
Okay, well, I'll start off, I'll preface it by quoting an old-time sports writer who described boxing as the red light district of sport. You know, this was 80 years ago and nothing has changed. Absolutely nothing has changed. I could run through a list of fighters who've been caught for doping, starting with the guy Canelo Alvarez, who is by consensus the pound for pound king, so the best boxer on earth. He's been caught, of course, he claimed it was Mexican beef. Tyson Fury, the world heavyweight champion. Roy Jones, one of the greatest middleweights of all time. Vitali Klitschko. Conor Benn, most recently in the UK, had his fight with Chris Eubank Jr. Cancelled as a consequence. Roy Jones, as I mentioned. And then closer to home, Kevin Lorena, who's now campaigning as a heavyweight. He was caught. Former heavyweight champion, a guy called Ruan Fisser, is still sitting out a ban. He was caught. Zolani Tete was an international world champion. He was, in fact, exposed in the UK. And they're still awaiting the results of his B sample, but almost inevitably we know what that result is going to be. And the great problem with boxing is there's no single federation that runs world boxing. So there's nothing stopping you or Ross from going off and starting a world boxing organization in your garage or in your flat at home with a fax machine or whatever the case is. There's nothing to stop you, and you can create a bogus title, that kind of thing. So the whole boxing environment is splintered. So while they talk, you know, talking of a world champion is a misnomer. You're not a world champion. You're a WBC champion, or you're an IBF champion, or a WBA, or an IBO champion. That's what you are. And for instance, when Lorena was caught, his team made a representation to Ed Levine, who was the president of the IBO, and it's that's fine. Okay, we accept it. And he was free to fight. And almost without fail, that is the case. Now, unfortunately for Rowan Fisser, he got a whole lot of lawyers on the side, spent a lot of money. He lost his case. And because it happened in the South African environment and SAFE was involved, they pushed very hard. And so he got a ban, and he's obviously sitting out that ban. But overseas, it's nothing less than a joke. What you might get is a 6-month suspension, which has zero effect because very few fighters are fighting more than twice a year anyway. If you're lucky, yeah, you might fight 3 times a year, just because that's the nature of the sport. There was an exception. There was a guy called Gerald Miller, who 2 weeks before he was going to fight Anthony Joshua for the World Heavyweight Championship, he blew up the testing cup, a cocktail of steroids, and he was thrown out for 2 years. He's busy making his way back. But those are the exceptions rather than the rule. Now, there is one very promising thing in boxing. So there's what's called VADA, which is a voluntary anti-doping association run by Dr. Margaret Goodman. And the World Boxing Council are aligned with this. And essentially, if you want to fight for a WBC title or something recognized for WBC, you have to be enrolled in the VADA program. Although, having said that, somebody like Canelo got busted. He got a slap on the wrist. I would say quite easily that boxing has the most lackluster, carefree, and lackadaisical attitude to doping out of all the sports.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
So when you say that they're being tested, if there's this kind of free-for-all situation, who's doing the testing? Because it sounds like they can decide if they want to be tested or not. I mean, is it... There's obviously an overarching body that says, well, we're still going to test you. Or is it only certain federations that test?
No. So, for instance, if you're fighting in the UK, you have the UK anti-doping people. They come in and test you. And remember, it's random. So it's not like all overseas fighters that come to South Africa are going to be tested. We had a case of a fighter coming up from Scandinavia. He was tested by SAIDS, and he... he blew hot on the test, and he went back home, and SAIDS couldn't do anything. They couldn't enforce anything. All they do is report the finding, and that's 3 months later, the guy was fighting again. It's very loose out there. No question. What happens in the US typically is VADA will do testing, and if you're enrolled, you have testing, and that's in fact how Conor Benn was caught. It also didn't help that his doctor is on record on YouTube and all sorts of about fighting or about challenging the dope testers, etc.
Mm-hmm. It's not a dissimilar situation then to when athletes come and compete. For instance, we have had a lot of Russian athletes come and compete in the Comrades Marathon, and there is strong suspicion and almost knowledge that these athletes are doping, but we can only test them in the window that they're in South Africa. And so all they have to do is time it right, and you would then be reliant on someone else doing that testing, and that someone else is Russian anti-doping, and look how that's gone. And that's why even outside of boxing, which sounds absolutely chaotic, I know not much about it, but even in athletics, where there is a World Anti-Doping Agency and national federations that supposedly function, you still had to have like the Athletics Integrity Unit. So these bodies exist almost as a solution to a problem. And the problem is that there's no valid, reliable, trustworthy and consistent anti-doping happening across the world.
One of the interesting examples that you use is of David George, a local South African cyclist who rode with Lance Armstrong back in the day, and he was caught a few years back. Tell us a bit about him, because first of all, he was unique in where he was obviously found guilty in what he did afterwards. But again, you try to contact him again. Just tell us a little bit about him and why he was such a unique case.
Yeah, he was very interesting because, as you say, unusually, he was a guy who put up his hand and he copped to doping, which was remarkable. And more than that, he decided he would cooperate with SAIDS. He was quite happy to cooperate. And so him and Khalid Galant, it was a bit of back and forth. And essentially what you can do is you can trade your honesty, you can those kind of things for leniency. I wasn't quite sure what motivated David, although I felt it might be kind of a cleansing for him. And what I did is I flew down, I met him, we went for dinner, he spoke about it, he was absolutely contrite. And as to your earlier point, what he had said, so he had started out, he cycled for US Postal. And, you know, that's a team obviously linked with Lance Armstrong. He wouldn't talk about it. He didn't even suggest that pressure was put on him related to Armstrong. But what he did say is he said, listen, everyone around you is doing it. And you just, you know, if you're going to be in the race, you have to do it. So which I found interesting. But it was also how he started small. And then, you know, that's obviously the gateway into more serious steroids. And I certainly got the hint that it was part of a broader reality, but maybe even a broader plan. Very specific plan within the team. And then how he was caught was that SAIDS went after him because there were suspicions around him. There'd been reports related to him as well. And as I spoke earlier, the costs associated with this, but SAIDS were quite comfortable and quite confident that pursuing him would result in a positive finding, which in fact is what happened.
Yeah.
Mm. You spoke there that he started small and then progressed. Did he tell you what that pathway was?
Yes, Clinton?
Ross, if I got your question right, it was just about the pathway. The sound is poor.
I was just asking, you mentioned that he started small and then progressed, and then you spoke about gateway. Did he explain to you what it was?
No, he didn't. But I got the idea. You know, the sexy choice at the time was EPO.
Yeah, because I just wonder, like, how they do it. So, like, how do you take the first step? There must be medical supervision. You're not going to go and get some yourself and inject it and so on. So, because I know David also. He runs and owns the bike shop that I buy a lot of things from, and we've spoken quite a lot. And it's quite clear that they were all, as you say, all doing it.
Okay.
And it had to have been delivered by some kind of formal system. But he's always been very reluctant to talk about anyone other than himself. And so he's never actually come clean about that element of it, only his own outcomes and actions.
Yeah, yeah. I think the question is, for me, is that if everybody says that these drugs are so easy available, you know, for instance, whether you go to a gym or whether you're a top cyclist, is it that easy? And how do people, you know, in other words, how do people get hold of the drugs? Is, if you're a top young cyclist and you enter a team, is there somebody that comes along and says, well, I've got the stuff that's going to make you better? Is it somebody within the team? Is it somebody within this, within that community that is making money out of selling the drugs to these type of riders and gym people, that sort of thing? I'm just very interested. I mean, I've never been offered drugs in my life, maybe because I'm not good enough, but it's, I'm always interested to know how it gets into the system. How do young people get attracted and pulled into that space?
Well, Mike, if you'll indulge me, I mean, I have my own experiences. About 20 years ago, I was a gym buddy, and I used to train with a big guy, a very seriously large guy, and we spoke about it. And then he said, let's go. And then one Sunday, we shot down to a chemist at Lyndhurst, which is a suburb in the northeast of Johannesburg. And he was out of the car in less than 2 minutes. He came back with, it was Decadurabilin and something else. And we went down to Bedford View, another suburb of Joburg, to the gym there. And I tried it, and they injected me in the butt. And then for about 6 weeks, I had a go. So this I got through a pill at gym. And then subsequently, I would I'd use ephedrine. And I'd get ephedrine. There was a gym shop next door, filling up with a guy who shared the same surname. And he'd happily supply me ephedrine, which was easy. And then years later, I would buy online. And I'd meet the guy in the car park at the shopping center. It was that easy, you know. It would change hands. He'd give me an envelope with the stuff in it, and it was done. And certainly, talking to athletes, teammates supply them often. And then in gyms, I mean, there's a gym famously in Joburg where they deal out of the car boot. So whatever you need, you know, the personal trainer, you shoot down to his car, and cash will be swapped, and you'll get sorted out. It's really not very difficult. You can do an online search, and probably take you about 5 to 10 minutes to find a reliable supplier.
So when you say you go to online, in other words, you just search it and then you'll find a website that provides that stuff or somebody who deals in it. I mean, where would you buy it online, for instance?
Yeah, very much. I mean, obviously the risk is you don't know what you're buying.
Yeah.
But there are some African-centric sites. You know, I'd sooner deal with Anabolics SA or whatever it is. They're dealing, and although it may come from China, ultimately, I don't want to deal with China directly, but it's not very well hidden. And we're not talking about the dark web or anything like that. It truly is as simple as a search. There are Reddit forums and things like that where guys are quite open about it. You see, because the thing is, there aren't many prosecutions for steroid use in South Africa. Of course, we spoke about the manufacturers, things like that, but no one's getting prosecuted for handing out steroids. And, you know, that's obviously part of the problem.
And do we know how people like the David Georges and the endurance athletes and those guys, I mean, they're not necessarily in a gym environment, but they are obviously being tempted by people who want to benefit from their performance, either financially by buying the stuff that's illegal or by having them perform well for their team. I mean, any idea about how they get that stuff? Is it the same way?
Well, I see the old the Team Sky doctor just this week. You know, he had his license taken away a couple of years ago, and now he was obviously trying to get reinstated, and he lost. So a lot of it, particularly in professional cycling, is through official channels within the team. You have a doctor overseeing its use. There's no question about that. I do know in local cycling, and I'm thinking of things like the Cape Epic and a lot of that off-road stuff as well, where SAIDs have targeted specific cyclists who are dealing. So that's obviously a lot less formal, but it's known that if you want some stuff, you go to a guy, and the guy fixes you up. A guy like Carlo Del Fava, the former Italian international, Sharks Lock as well, one of his teammates, you know, he was talking about getting over injury, and one of his teammates said, oh, you should try this. Johan Ackermann, a former Springbok, who's now coaching as well, he had a bad injury, and he was a policeman. And one of his police colleagues said, yeah, you need to take this to sort out your knee injury. So, it ranges from obviously proper doctors and medical experts who are administering it to, you know, the casual guy in the gym who's just trying to help out a buddy.
Yeah.
Mm.
How much of the, you mentioned in a couple of chapters that a lot of the excuses that are used by sports people is that they were naive to what they were taking. So they were either taking something that they thought was perfectly fine and it turns out that it's tainted. There's obviously cases of supplements that are easily available on the shelf that have been tainted. You mentioned some of the brands even in your book. Do you think that there is a valid excuse for people that are just not informed about what they can and cannot take? Because it is a pretty much a minefield. You and I and Ross can sit and talk about it because we are in the space and we would know what is at risk. But if you're a young 20, 21-year-old, is there really enough education out there to make sure that they don't take stuff they're not allowed to take?
Well, there's a lot of education. Is there enough? I couldn't be sure. Now, the supplements one is a very interesting one because it often leads to a gray area. Think of the recent case of Karina Horn, who fought it, claimed her supplements were tainted. And so
she's a sprinter. Yeah.
That's correct. The fastest woman in South African history. And she was eventually exonerated. So they conceded that there was no fault on her side. She was exonerated. Right. And she's back running again. There are several instances of that. And then you have a case of a guy like Damart Penna, who was a mixed martial arts champion, and he claimed his supplements had been tainted. But then, quite smartly, the medical experts would say, well, listen, at that level of steroids found in his supplement, you'd have to have like 600 injections, something like that. The supplements one I found to be a very convenient excuse and a very common excuse. It was the same one Roland Schumann used as well in his defense, and he finally, you know, he got that Russian doctor who exposed a lot of the Russian doping system. He got him on his case to help defend him as well. But strange enough, with steroids and everything like that, it is, you know, very different, guilty or not guilty when you talk with steroids. But the supplements is a very tricky one, and chiefly, I think, because the whole industry is unregulated. There was a case of a supplements company supplying to Macro. The supplements were put together in a guy's garage, and the people were working barefoot and kind of stirring things into buckets. You know, it's like a circus, and people are quite cavalier about it. But, you know, I'm a believer in strict liability, which is, you know, what's found in your system is it's up to you. And I think in this day and age, when you know, elite athletes, certainly professional athletes, they should be well aware of the risks of taking supplements. So you're going to be absolutely crazy if you're just pulling something off the shelf.
Yeah, with one or two exceptions, maybe, in minors. It'll be interesting to get your thoughts on that in a moment. Just on the supplements issue, two anecdotes on my end. I've been contacted a few times in the last decade by athletes who failed tests, and 100% of the time they're blaming a supplement. So, okay. So then you say to them, you need to go and have your supplement tested, because if you can show that that's the supplement you took the night or two nights, whatever, before the test, and that supplement contained the banned substance, and that you took every precaution to ensure that supplement didn't contain a banned substance, then you can, as Clinton says, get exonerated. And it does happen. I'd love to know the proportion of times it works. It's not high, but it can. And one guy was a sub-elite veteran mountain biker. He claimed that. But the problem he had was the same as the MMA guy, where the amount that was found in his urine was so high that when he had that supplement tested, he needed to find levels of the steroid hormone in that supplement that were like through the roof. But he didn't, but he persisted with his case, and he ended up going to the appeal, having been given a 2-year ban in South Africa, and they made it 6 years on appeal. So that's where it can at least backfire when you play that card. And then the other one, just to make people aware of how unbelievably random this world is there's a famous case, I won't say who it is, of an athlete who blamed drinking the wrong supplement. And he claimed that the person whose supplement he was drinking was using the banned substance. And this guy testified on his behalf. He said, yes, I was using a supplement into which I was adding a banned product. Okay, so in other words, the supplement was legal, but I was adding extra stuff to it, which was banned. So they send the supplement off for testing, and they send the banned thing off to test it. Turns out that the banned drug has nothing in it. So it's just water. But the supplement, the supplement that was supposed to contain nothing banned contains the banned drug that was supposed to be in the banned drug. So he ends up being positive and he gets banned because he's liable. But for an accidental contamination of a supplement, even though he was taking a banned drug, but that one was clean. You couldn't make the stuff up.
I was going to say, he's getting struck by lightning one day.
Yeah, that's what happens. He's won the anti-lottery because there is, like Clinton says, no regulation. And the same factory that makes the steroid hormones you can get online makes the legal supplements, but without any assurance that they're not accidentally mixing them. And I suspect some of them mix them on purpose because supplements generally don't work. Protein powders are generally not very effective. Steroids, on the other hand, are. And so if you want repeat customers, it pays to actually put something in your supplement that actually helps.
Yeah.
And so I think they spike them on purpose sometimes.
And within supplements, I mean, we talked about this before, there are batches that you have to test. So one supplement might be fine and another batch might not be fine. So one supplement can be a different batch and have a completely different result, which is terrifying. Exactly. That's why I was suggesting that, you know, if you're a youngster and you want to just take something when you go for your ride or when you're training, you know, it's easy to take something off the shelf and you assume, and I agree that there is liability there for sure, but you would assume that you would get, if you go into a normal shop and buy a supplement, that it would that it should be safe. And if I was a young, talented, you know, pro sportsman, it would be, I'd feel quite hard done by if I suddenly was caught doping with something that I didn't necessarily believe was real. But I guess liability is key. But I do think there is some room for maneuver in that. I mean, Clinton, would you give us that, or would you suggest that we need to be a bit harder, take a harder line on that?
Yeah, I'm okay taking a hard line with what you might call the hardcore users. But I've seen the grey area I mentioned earlier does revolve around around this, you know, protein shakes and things like that. No question. Of course, when you've got something that's been injected into the system, that's a different story altogether. And then the other one where I'm happy to give a pass to, I spoke in a book about a 14-year-old who got done with steroids, and I think if you're a minor, somebody else is complicit in that, and that's an adult. It's a parent, or it's a coach, it's a manager, or something like that. Supplements certainly muddy the waters. There's no question about that.
The sad thing about that case is that she was, that I think you're talking about, was the youngest steroid case in the world. Is she still the youngest steroid case that you know of? At the time, she wasn't in the world.
Yes, to my knowledge. Now, SAIDS is quite interesting because SAIDS annually put out a list of athletes who have been found to be positive, and they're always names that are redacted, and they're redacted because they're minors. And I know of one or two rugby players who got caught as minors and then got subsequently caught as seniors. I know a very prominent South African athlete who was caught as a minor, but it hasn't been reported. And he's enjoyed a very high profile in his sport, which in fact isn't rugby anymore. So there are cases like that. So my assumption is that she's very near to being the youngest, but it may have been surpassed.
Yeah, I don't know either. I looked for this actually in preparation. I do know that there are surveys of young athletes asking them to confess, and the youngest in those surveys is 12.
Wow.
They've never been caught, so they don't count on the official record, but self-admissions goes down to the age of 12. And then there have been some very high-profile international cases. Last year in the Winter Olympics, Kamila Valieva was the ice skater at 15, blamed the doctor. Well, no, she said it was an accidental ingestion of the grandfather's medicines. So it was that. Mm. The one who blamed the doctor was in your Olympics 2000, you alluded to earlier, was Radican, the Romanian gymnast, won the all-round gold, failed it for a stimulant, a drug test, and said that she'd been given Nurofen. Most listeners would know that as a common cold remedy, which contains a banned substance. And that was then blamed on the doctor. So she ended up having her medal taken away, but not liable for her own doping offense. Instead, the doctor got a fairly lengthy ban, costing Romanian Olympics that gold medal. So that can happen. And I'm sympathetic to those athletes. But you have to have strict liability in the system because it's unprovable as to whether you took it on purpose or not. Mm. So if you didn't have that strict liability, then the whole thing would collapse in on itself.
Mm. Yeah. My final question, Clinton, to you, based on everything we've discussed so far, who is winning the war?
No one's winning the war. It's more a case of cat and mouse. So I think you obviously have those who are doping, and there's always new developments in doping. You know, the sort of newer ones are called SARMs, and that's kind of quite fashionable. And then what happens is the medical experts come along and they try to shut it down. And then there's what they now talk about are designer drugs. These things keep happening. Like I said, it's a game of cat and mouse, and just the numbers of athletes who keep getting caught, it's staggering. It remains extraordinarily high, obviously far too high. And, you know, so that's encouraging because they're getting caught. But the numbers suggest that people still feel the risk is worth it, and they're taking the chances. So you can imagine those who are getting caught, how many are not getting caught?
Yeah.
So while WADA have this this great fight, I think, you know, they do a great job. It's often left to individual countries to police what's going on. And I think they're quite cavalier in places like Kenya. We aren't to know what's happening in sort of smaller countries in Eastern Europe, although we have an idea given the Russian situation. So the answer, and I'm sitting a little bit on the fence, is I don't think anyone's winning.
Yeah, so a couple of points on that. Many years ago, there was Michael Shermer used to write a piece in Scientific American called The Skeptic, and he's a very keen cyclist, and he wrote one on doping, and he ended up applying game theory, you know, from economics to the doping situation. And he was saying that to not dope would be irrational. And he says it's a rational decision to dope because the rewards are so large and the risk is so low. And the risk is low for two reasons. One is the likelihood of being tested and caught is very low. And number two is when you are caught, the sanction isn't high enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so he worked out and he showed this, he used economics theory that I don't fully understand, but he ended up showing that until you change that balance, you won't change the incentives to dope. So that's why people dope. What's missing from the debate, in my opinion, is that they don't really have a true idea of the doping prevalence. And so when they have any sport or any federation, when they report 3.4% of all our tests were positive, that has no meaning, because they don't know what it should have been. It's a known unknown.
Mm.
Now, there are some methods that you can use to try and establish it, like surveying athletes, and there are some nifty little statistical adjustments you can use, and you can look at the biological passports, and you can say, okay, only 1% of these are abnormal, but 25% are dodgy. So with some confidence, we can say the problem is bigger than we're detecting.
Mm.
But instead, what happens is, and this happened last year in cycling, is the president will come out and say, we're doing really well because we haven't had any positive tests. And you say, that's actually a sign that you're doing terribly badly because you're assuming you shouldn't have had any positive tests. Most onlookers would say you should have some. And so having zero is a sign of underperformance. Mm. But nobody knows where that bar should be. And therefore, they can't interpret what is. That makes sense,
yeah.
Right? So that's going to continue to, I think, hold anti-doping back in a significant way. And what it points to, I think, and this is my question to you, it's a long question, is in your discussions, especially with SAIDS, and you've been quite complimentary of them, and certainly they've done a good deal of investigative work to target their testing. Do they feel that they get the necessary investigative support, or they're still reliant on testing to do this? Because testing to me has been shown to be relatively ineffective, whereas investigation seems to be what uncovers doping.
Very good question. And I put it to Khalid Khalant about the level of testing. And he said, you know, how much is enough? You know, he said, yes, it's enough, and it isn't enough. And he's often hauled before Parliament, and he has to explain numbers, that kind of thing. And what I'm encouraged by is they have, I think it's a former Hawks police officer. So Hawks is obviously the specialist police investigations arm. So they have a former Hawks officer on board where they do these kind of investigations you talk of, which I think is fantastic, because you know, they don't necessarily have the means otherwise to be able to pursue often quite shady characters and quite organized crime syndicates, no question. The other thing Khalid Khalant from SAID said to me, which is interesting, he reckons our rate of testing positive is higher than any country in the world, which for me was quite alarming. So that's obviously the rate at which we're testing and how many come back as positive as well. But I do think that aspect of intel is vital, and they are using it. But SAID effectively operates with a government grant, so their funding is limited.
Yeah. But even that stat of like positive tests returned or test positivity, let's say they test 100 athletes and 17% are positive. I compare that to UK, Italy, Kenya, and it's in the single percentages, right? So we say, oh, that's bad in South Africa. It could be that we're just smarter about testing and we use intelligence more effectively so that you don't waste as many tests as they do overseas. And I've got no doubt that a number of countries test athletes to pad the numbers. You know, they'll test athletes with no intention of catching them, knowing that they're not going to get anything. Pad the numbers, produce one or two positives, make it look like they're doing enough, but they don't really want to address the biggest problems, you know, where they're, so there's no will, there's no real appetite to go after them. So that to me continues to be a problem.
You should write a column called The Cynic.
Yeah, or The Realist. Or The Realist, it's a spectrum, depending on what day you catch me on. Did you come across anything in the book that you think SAIDs didn't know? Like, did you find anything out that they weren't already aware of? I suppose it's hard to know, but...
Yeah, that's a good question. I'm just thinking. I don't think so. And in fact, I was alerted to several cases I was unaware of. I think they have a reasonably good handle. But equally, I think a lot of what they discover doesn't make its way into the public domain.
Right.
Things that are going on, athletes they're cooperating with. I mean, there's a case now of a very prominent athlete who's turned whistleblower, and he goes back and forth, and he's trying to get his ban reduced almost on a monthly basis. And so he gives a little bit of information, and he says, what am I getting? So a lot of that stuff goes on behind the scenes. But I don't think anything overly dramatic. The one thing which is very interesting and quite uniquely South African, I know they've been hauled over the coals for testing more black athletes than white athletes. And one of the smart MPs turned around and said, why are you making our black athletes look bad? This kind of thing, which is obviously absurd, because there's no sort of racial dimension to testing at all. And this goes, what I will say is that, you know, in the defense of some of the, I remember Ludwig Mamabolo, the comrades runner, what he spoke about is he said, listen, we don't have access to education. You know, all we do is we eat and we train and we run, and we don't have laptops. We don't, you know, we're not connected to the web, those kind of things. So you do have those kind of uniquely South African situations, which I guess you do have to take into consideration.
Yeah, I guess the reason I asked that, I was getting at, is do anti-doping authorities make maximal use of whistleblowers and informants? You know, are they adopting the right approaches and the right incentives to try and discover more? And it's often bemused me why they don't go more aggressively after the supply chain than the athletes. And that's a global problem, like the entourage, as they call it now in WADA terminology. An athlete's not doping in isolation at that level. So whether it's a tennis player, an athlete, rugby, whatever it is, if you came down harder on the team around the person, it feels to me it might be more effective than just the athlete. But whenever I see these positive cases, it's always just one guy who's taking the bullet for the rest of the team.
Well, what can you do to the supply chain? You can obviously ban the athlete, but if you find out who's dealing it, what does something like the South African anti-doping guys do against somebody who might be a supplier?
So at its furthest extreme, Russia is an example of what gets done eventually, because the whole country got banned.
Yeah.
On a smaller scale, like we've spoken here on this podcast about Kenya, and you say, all right, is Kenya going to get a blanket exclusion from World Athletics Champs? Maybe that's not entirely fair, but that's where I'd want to see if 80% of those Kenyan cases are coming from athletes managed by one agent, coached by one coach. That to me is grounds to go after the whole squad and ban all of them, because then you shift the incentives more strongly so that you start to say to innocent athletes, you best speak up here, because if you don't speak up, you're going to be caught up in the crossfire of your doping colleagues. So you try and encourage, and I suppose you can create like chaos this way, but it just seems like that would maybe create more channels for information and informants that would then do more on testing. You know what I mean? Like,
seems quite harsh, I'll be honest.
yeah, but yeah. It's equally harsh when you lose medals and titles to people who are doping.
Right? Yeah. Clinton Oberg, it's been fascinating chatting to you. Just for those of our listeners that are overseas, can they get the book overseas, or is it available as an ebook somewhere?
Yes, indeed, it is available via Amazon. So if you have a Kindle, you can do so electronically. And unfortunately, it's not available in bookshops overseas. It's available locally. But happily, via Kindle is the way to go if you are overseas.
Great. So that's the book, Guns and Needles, A Journey into the Heart of South African Sport and Steroid and Drug Culture. It really is a fascinating book. And I've sort of scanned through most of it and read about half of it. And it really is a great read and fascinating just to, and it's not just about, what's it love about the book is it's not just about drugs. It's almost the history of the sport in South Africa. So for those of the listeners that are here in South Africa, I would definitely think if you're even remotely interested in South African sport, it's a great book to read. So Clinton, well done on the book, and thanks so much for your time.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on Twitter at SportsciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport Podcast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.